Everybody in the Caucasian village was dead except the village idiot, whose perfect passivity to the inevitable kept making her think of her companion. She tried some rewarmed coffee, but it tasted like lye. She went to the door and stood half inside, half outside for a while, listening to the creek shouting and hollering, "Eternal praise! Eternal praise!" It was incredible that it had kept up that tremendous noise for hundreds of years before she was even born, and would go on doing it until the mountains moved. And the strangest thing about it, now very late at night, in the absolute silence of the woods, was a distant note in it, far away, upstream it seemed, like the voices of children singing. Very sweet, very strange. She got shivery. She shut the door on the voices of the unborn children singing in the water, and turned to the small warm room and the sleeping man. She took down a book on home carpentry, which he had evidently brought to keep himself busy about the cabin, but it put her to sleep at once. Well, why not? Why did she have to stay up? But where was she supposed to sleep? She should have left George on the floor. He never would have noticed. It wasn't fair. He had both the cot and the sleeping bag. She removed the sleeping bag from him, replacing it with his raincoat and her rain cape. He never stirred. She looked at him with affection, then got into the sleeping bag down on the floor. Christ, it was cold down here on the floor, and hard. She hadn't blown out the light. Or did you turn out wick lamps? She should do one and shouldn't do the other. She remembered that from the commune, but she couldn't remember which. Oh, shit, it was cold down here. Cold, cold, hard, bright, too bright. Sunrise in the window through shift and flicker of trees. Over the bed. The floor trembled. The hills muttered and dreamed of falling in the sea, and over the hills, faint and horrible, the sirens of distant towns howled, howled, howled. She sat up. The wolves howled for the world's end. Sunrise poured in through the single window, hiding all that lay under its dazzling slant. She felt through excess of light and found the dreamer sprawled on his face, still sleeping. "George, wake up! Oh, George, please wake up! Something is wrong!" He woke. He smiled at her, waking. "Something is wrong! The sirens! What is it?" Still, almost in his dream, he said without emotion, "They've landed." For he had done just what she told him to do. She had told him to dream that the aliens were no longer on the moon. Chapter 8. Heaven and Earth Are Not Humane. Lao Tse, 5. In the Second World War, the only part of the American mainland to suffer direct attack was the state of Oregon. Some Japanese fire balloons set a piece of forest burning on the coast. In the First Interstellar War, the only part of the American mainland to be invaded was the state of Oregon. One might lay the blame on her politicians. The historic function of a senator from Oregon is to drive all the other senators mad, and no military butter is ever put upon the state bread. Oregon had no stockpiles of anything but hay, no missile launch pads, no NASA bases. She was obviously defenseless. The anti-alien ballistic missiles defending her went up from the enormous underground installations in Walla Walla, Washington, and Round Valley, California, from Idaho, most of which belonged to the U.S. Air Force. Huge supersonic XXTT-9900s went screaming west, shattering every eardrum from Boise to Sun Valley, to patrol for any alien ship that might somehow slip through the infallible network of the AABMs. Repelled by the alien ships, which carried a device that took control of the missile's guidance systems, the AABMs turned around somewhere in the middle stratosphere and returned, landing and exploding here and there over the state of Oregon. Holocausts raged on the dry eastern slopes of the Cascades. Gold Beach and the Dalles were wiped out by firestorms. Portland was not directly hit, but an errant nuclear warhead, AABM, striking Mount Hood near the old crater caused the dormant volcano to wake up. Steam and ground tremors ensued at once, and by noon of the first day of the alien invasion, April Fool's Day, a vent had opened on the northwestern side and was in violent eruption. Lava flow set the snowless, deforested slopes blazing and threatened the communities of Zigzag and Rhododendron. A cinder cone began to form, and the air in Portland, 40 miles away, was soon thickening and gray with ash. As evening came and the wind changed round to the south, the lower air cleared somewhat, revealing the somber orange flicker of the eruption in the eastern clouds. The sky, full of rain and ashes, thundered with the flights of XXTT-9900s, vainly seeking alien ships. Other flights of bombers and fighters were still coming in from the East Coast and from fellow nations of the Pact. These frequently shot each other down. The ground shook with earthquake and the impact of bombs and plane crashes. One of the alien ships had landed only 8 miles from the city limits, and so the southwestern outskirts of town were pulverized as jet bombers methodically devastated the 11-square-mile area in which the alien ship was said to have been. As a matter of fact, information had arrived that it was no longer there. But something had to be done. Bombs fell by mistake on many other parts of the city, as will happen with jet bombing. There was no glass left in any window downtown. It lay instead in all the downtown streets, in small fragments, an inch or two deep. Refugees from southwest Portland had to walk through it. Women carried their children and walked, weeping with pain, in thin shoes full of broken glass. William Haber stood at the great window of his office in the Oregon Onirological Institute, watching the fires flare and wane down in the docks, and the bloody lightning of the eruption. There was still glass in that window. Nothing had landed or exploded yet near Washington Park, and the ground tremors that cracked open whole buildings down in the river bottom so far had done nothing worse up in the hills than rattle the window frames. Very faintly, he could hear elephants screaming over in the zoo. Streaks of an unusual purplish light showed occasionally to the north, perhaps over the area where the Willamette joins the Columbia. It was hard to locate anything for certain in the ashy, misty twilight. Large sections of the city were blacked out by power failure. Other parts twinkled faintly, though the street lights had not been turned on. No one else was in the Institute building. Haber had spent all day trying to locate George Orr. When his search proved futile, and further search was made impossible by the hysteria and increasing dilapidation of the city, he had come up to the Institute. He had had to walk most of the way, and had found the experience unnerving. A man in his position, with so many calls on his time, of course drove a bat car. But the battery gave out, and he couldn't get to a recharger because the crowds in the street were so thick. He had to get out and walk. Against the current of the crowd, facing them all, right in amongst them. That had been distressing. He did not like crowds, but then the crowds had ceased, and he was left walking all alone in the vast expanses of lawn and grove and forest of the park, and that was a great deal worse. Haber considered himself a lone wolf. He had never wanted marriage nor close friendships. He had chosen a strenuous research carried out when others sleep. He had avoided entanglements. He kept his sex life almost entirely to one-night stands, semi-pros, sometimes women and sometimes young men. He knew which bars and cinemas and saunas to go for what he wanted. He got what he wanted and got clear again before he or the other person could possibly develop any kind of need for the other. He prized his independence, his free will. But he found it terrible to be alone, all alone in the huge, indifferent park, hurrying, almost running, toward the Institute, because he did not have anywhere else to go. He got there, and it was all silent, all deserted. Miss Crouch kept a transistor radio in her desk drawer. He got this, and kept it on softly, so he could hear the latest reports, or anyway, hear a human voice. Everything he needed was here. Beds, dozens of them, food, the sandwich and soft drink machines for the all-night workers in the sleep labs. But he was not hungry. He felt instead a kind of apathy. He listened to the radio, but it would not listen to him. He was all alone, and nothing seemed to be real in solitude. He needed somebody, anybody, to talk to. He had to tell them what he felt, so that he knew if he felt anything. This horror of being by himself was strong enough that it almost drove him out of the Institute and down into the crowds again. But the apathy was still stronger than the fear. He did nothing, and the night darkened. Over Mount Hood, the reddish glow sometimes spread enormously, then paled again. Something big hid in the southwest of town, out of view from his office, and soon the clouds were lit from beneath, like a livid glare that seemed to rise from that direction. Haber was going out into the corridor to see what could be seen, carrying the radio with him. People were coming up the stairs. He had not heard them. For a moment, he merely stared at them. "Dr. Haber," one of them said. It was Orr. "It's about time," Haber said bitterly. "Where the hell have you been all day? Come on." Orr came up limping. The left side of his face was swollen and bloody, his lip was cut, and he had lost half a front tooth. The woman with him looked less battered but more exhausted, glassy-eyed, knees giving. Orr made her sit down on the couch in the office. Haber said in a loud medical voice, "She get a blow on the head?" "No, it's been a long day." "I'm all right," the woman mumbled, shivering a little. Orr was quick and solicitous, taking off her repulsively muddy shoes and putting the camel's hair blanket from the foot of the couch over her. Haber wondered who she was, but gave it only the one thought. He was beginning to function again. "Let her rest there. She'll be all right. Come here, clean yourself up. I spent the whole day looking for you. Where were you?"
"Trying to get back to town. There was some kind of bombing pattern we ran into. They blew up the road just ahead of the car. Car bounced around a lot, turned over, I guess. Heather was behind me and stopped in time. So her car was all right and we came on in it. But we have to cut over to the Sunset Highway because 99 was all blown up, and then we had to leave the car at a roadblock out near the bird sanctuary, so we walked in through the park."
"Where the hell were you coming from?" Haber had run hot water in his private washroom sink, and now gave Orr a steaming towel to hold to his bloody face.
"Cabin in the Coast Range."
"What's wrong with your leg?"
"Bruised it when the car turned over, I guess. Listen, are they in the city yet?"
"If the military knows, it's not telling. All they'll say is that when the big ships landed this morning, they split into small mobile units, something like helicopters, and scattered. They're all over the western half of the state. They're reported to be slow-moving, but if they're shooting them down, they don't report it."
"We saw one."
Orr's face emerged from the towel, marked with purple bruises, but less shocking now the blood and mud were off.
"That's what it must have been. Little silvery thing, about 30 feet up, over a pasture near North Plains. It seemed to sort of hop along. Didn't look earthly. Are the aliens fighting us? Are they shooting planes down?"
"The radio doesn't say. No losses are reported except civilians. Now come on, let's get some coffee and food into you, and then, by God, we'll have a therapy session in the middle of hell and put an end to this idiotic mess you've made." He had prepared a shot of sodium pentothal and now took Orr's arm and gave him the shot without warning or apology.
"That's why I came here, but I don't know if..."
"If you can do it, you can. Come on."
Orr was hovering over the woman again.
"She's all right. She's asleep. Don't bother her. It's what she needs. Come on."
He took Orr down to the food machines and got him a roast beef sandwich, an egg and tomato sandwich, 2 apples, 4 chocolate bars, and 2 cups of coffee with. They sat down at a table in Sleep Lab 1, sweeping aside a patient's layout that had been abandoned at dawn when the sirens began to howl.
"Okay, eat.
Now, in case you think that clearing up this mess is beyond you, forget it. I've been working on the augmenter, and it can do it for you. I've got the model, the template, of your brain emissions during effective dreaming. Where I went wrong all month was in looking for an entity, an omega wave. There isn't one. It's simply a pattern formed by the combination of other waves. And over this last couple of days, before all hell broke loose, I finally worked it out. The cycle is 97 seconds. That means nothing to you, even though it's your goddamn brain doing it. Put it this way. When you're dreaming effectively, your entire brain is involved in a complexly synchronized pattern of emissions that takes 97 seconds to complete itself and start again, a kind of counterpoint effect that is to ordinary D-state graphs what Beethoven's Great Fugue is to Mary Had a Little Lamb. It is incredibly complex, yet it's consistent and it recurs. Therefore, I can feed it to you straight and amplified. The augmenter's all set up. It's ready for you. It's really going to fit the inside of your head at last. When you dream this time, you'll dream big, baby. Big enough to stop this crazy invasion and get us clean over into another continuum where we can start fresh. That's what you do, you know. You don't change things or lives. You shift the whole continuum. It's nice to be able to talk about it with you, Orr said, or something like it. He had eaten the sandwiches incredibly fast, despite his cut mouth and broken tooth, and was now engulfing a chocolate bar. There was irony or something in what he said, but Haber was much too busy to bother about it. Listen, did this invasion just happen, or did it happen because you missed an appointment?
I dreamed it.
You let yourself have an uncontrolled, effective dream? Haber let the heavy anger lie in his voice. He had been too protective, too easy on Orr. Orr's irresponsibility was the cause of the death of many innocent people, the wreckage of panic loose in the city. He must face up to what he had done.
It wasn't, Orr was just beginning, when a really big explosion hit. The building jumped, rang, crackled, electronic apparatus leaped about by the row of empty beds, coffee slopped in the cups.
Was that the volcano or the Air Force? Orr said, and in the midst of the natural dismay the explosion had caused him, Haber noticed that Orr seemed quite undismayed. His reactions were utterly abnormal. On Friday, he had been going all to pieces over a mere ethical point. Here on Wednesday, in the midst of Armageddon, he was cool and calm. He seemed to have no personal fear. But he must have. If Haber was afraid, of course, Orr must be. He was suppressing fear. Or did he think, Haber suddenly wondered, that because he had dreamed the invasion, it was all just a dream? What if it was? Whose?
We'd better get back upstairs, Haber said, getting up.
He felt increasingly impatient and irritable. The excitement was getting too extensive.
Who's the woman with you, anyway?
That's Miss Leelock, Orr said, looking at him oddly. The lawyer. She was here Friday.
How'd she happen to be with you?
She was looking for me. Came to the cabin after me.
You can explain all that later, Haber said. There was no time to waste on this trivia.
They had to get out, of this burning, exploding world. Just as they entered Haber's office, the glass burst out of the great double window with a shrill singing sound and a huge sucking out of air. Both men were impelled toward the window, as if toward the mouth of a vacuum cleaner. Everything then turned white. Everything. They both fell over. Neither was aware of any noise. When they could see again, Haber scrambled up, holding on to his desk. Orr was already over by the couch, trying to reassure the bewildered woman. It was cold in the office. The spring air had a moist chill in it, pouring in the empty windows, and it smelled of smoke, burnt insulation, ozone, sulfur, and death.
"We ought to get down into the basement, don't you think?" Miss Leelock said in a reasonable tone, though she was shivering hard.
"Go on," Haber said. "We've got to stay up here a while."
"Stay here?"
The augmenter's here. It doesn't plug in and out like a portable TV. Go on down into the basement. We'll join you when we can.
You're going to put him to sleep now? The woman said, as the trees down the hill suddenly burst into bright yellow balls of flame. The eruption of Mount Hood was quite hidden by events closer at hand. The earth, however, had been trembling gently for the past few minutes, a sort of fundamental palsy that made one's hands and mind shake sympathetically.
You're fucking right I am. Go on. Get down to the basement. I need the couch.
Lie down, George. Listen, you, in the basement, just past the janitor's room, you'll see a door marked emergency generator. Go in there. Find the on handle. Have your hand on it. And if the lights fail, turn it on. It'll take a heavy pressure upward on the handle. Go on.
She went. She was still shaking and smiling. As she went, she caught Orr's hand for a second and said, "Pleasant dreams, George."
"Don't worry," Orr said. "It's all right."
"Shut up," Haber snapped. He had switched on the hypnotape he had recorded himself, but Orr wasn't even paying attention, and the noise of the explosions and things burning made it hard to hear.
"Shut your eyes," Haber commanded, put his hand on Orr's throat and turned up the gain.
"Relaxing," said his own huge voice. "You feel comfortable and relaxed. You will enter the..."
The building leaped like a spring lamb and settled down askew. Something appeared in the dirty red opaque glare outside the glassless window, an ovoid large object moving in a sort of hopping fashion through the air. It came directly toward the window.
"We've got to get out," Haber shouted over his own voice, and then realized that Orr was already hypnotized.
He snapped the tape off and leaned down so he could speak in Orr's ear.
"Stop the invasion," he shouted. "Peace, peace. Dream that we're at peace with everybody. Now sleep. Antwerp."
And he switched on the augmenter. But he had no time to look at Orr's EEG. The ovoid shape was hovering directly outside the window, its blunt snout lit luridly by reflections of the burning city, pointed straight at Haber. He cowered down by the couch, feeling horribly soft and exposed, trying to protect the augmenter with his inadequate flesh, stretching out his arms across it. He craned over his shoulder to watch the alien ship. It pressed closer, the snout, looking like oily steel, silver with violet streaks and gleams, filled the entire window. There was a crunching, racking sound as it jammed itself into the frame. Haber sobbed aloud with terror but stayed spread out there between the alien and the augmenter. The snout, halting, emitted a long, thin tentacle which moved about questioningly in the air. The end of it, rearing like a cobra, pointed at random, then settled in Haber's direction. About 10 feet from him it hung in the air and pointed at him for some seconds. Then it withdrew with a hiss and a crack, like a carpenter's flexible rule, and a high humming noise came from the ship. The metal sill of the window screeched and buckled. The ship's snout whirled around and fell off onto the floor. From the hole that gaped behind it, something emerged. It was, Haber thought in emotionless horror, a giant turtle. Then he realized that it was encased in a suit of some kind, which gave it a bulky, greenish, armored, inexpressive look, like a giant sea turtle standing on its hind legs. It stood quite still near Haber's desk. Very slowly it raised its left arm, pointing at him like a metallic-nozzled instrument. He faced death. A flat, toneless voice came out of the elbow joint.
"Do not do to others what you wish others not to do to you," it said.
Haber stared, his heart faltering. The huge, heavy metallic arm came up again.
"We are attempting to make peaceful arrival," the elbow said, all on one note. "Please inform others that this is peaceful arrival. We do not have any weapons. Great self-destruction follows upon unfounded fear. Please cease destruction of self and others. We do not have any weapons. We are non-aggressive, unfighting species."
I
I can't control the Air Force, Haber stammered.
Persons in flying vehicles are being contacted presently, the creature's elbow joint said. Is this a military installation?
Word order showed it to be a question.
No, Haber said. No, nothing of the kind.
Please, then, excuse unwarranted intrusion.
The huge armored figure whirred slightly and seemed to hesitate.
What is device? It said, pointing with its right elbow joint at the machinery connected to the head of the sleeping man.
An electroencephalograph. A machine which records the electrical activity of the brain.
Worthy, said the alien, and took a short, checked step toward the couch, as if longing to look.
The individual person is Iaklu. The recording machine records this, perhaps. Is all your species capable of Iaklu?
I don't know the term. Can you describe?
The figure whirred a little, raised its left elbow over its head, which, turtle-like, hardly protruded above the great sloped shoulders of the carapace, and said,
Please excuse. Incommunicable by communication machine invented hastily in very recent past. Please excuse. It is necessary that all we proceed in very near future rapidly toward other responsible individual persons engaged in panic and capable of destroying selves and others. Thank you very much. And it crawled back into the nose of the ship.
Haber watched the great round soles of its feet disappear into the dark cavity. The nose cone jumped up from the floor and twirled itself smartly into place. Haber had a vivid impression that it was not acting mechanically, but temporally, repeating its previous actions in reverse, precisely like a film run backward. The alien ship, jarring the office and tearing out the rest of the window frame with a hideous noise, withdrew and vanished into the lurid murk outside. The crescendo of explosions, Haber now realized, had ceased. In fact, it was fairly quiet. Everything trembled a little, but that would be the mountain, not the bombs. Sirens whooped far and desolate across the river. George Orr lay inert on the couch, breathing irregularly, the cuts and swellings on his face looking ugly on his pallor. Cinders and fumes still drifted in the chill, choking air through the smashed window. Nothing had been changed. He had undone nothing. Had he done anything yet? There was a slight eye movement under the closed lids. He was still dreaming. He could not do otherwise, with the augmenter overriding the impulses of his own brain. Why didn't he change continuums? Why didn't he get them into a peaceful world, as Haber had told him to? The hypnotic suggestion hadn't been clear or strong enough. They must start all over. Haber switched off the augmenter and spoke Orr's name thrice.
Don't sit up. The augmenter hookup's still on you. What did you dream?
Orr spoke huskily and slowly, not fully awakened.
An alien was here. In here, in the office. It came out of the nose of one of their hopping ships. In the window. You and it were talking together.
But that's not a dream. That happened. God damn, we'll have to do this over again. That might have been an atomic blast a few minutes ago. We've got to get into another continuum. We may all be dead of radiation exposure already.
Oh, not this time, Orr said, sitting up and combing off electrodes as if they were dead lice.
Of course it happened. An effective dream is a reality, Dr. Haber.
Haber stared at him.
I suppose your augmenter increased the immediacy of it for you, Orr said, still with extraordinary calmness. He appeared to ponder for a little. Listen, couldn't you call Washington?
What for?
Well, a famous scientist right here in the middle of it all might get listened to. They'll be looking for explanations. Is there somebody in the government you know that you might call? Maybe the HEU minister? You could tell him that the whole thing's a misunderstanding, the aliens aren't invading or attacking. They simply didn't realize until they landed that humans depend on verbal communication. They didn't even know we thought we were at war with them. If you could tell somebody, who can get the president's ear? The sooner Washington can call off the military, the fewer people will be killed here. It's only civilians getting killed. The aliens aren't hurting the soldiers. They aren't even armed. And I have the impression that they're indestructible in those suits. But if somebody doesn't stop the Air Force, they'll blow up the whole city. Give it a try, Dr. Haber. They might listen to you.
Haber felt that Orr was right. There was no reason to it. It was the logic of insanity. But there it was, his chance. Orr spoke with the incontrovertible conviction of dream, in which there is no free will. Do this. You must do it. It is to be done. Why had this gift been given to a fool, a passive nothing of a man? Why was Orr so sure and so right, while the strong, active, positive man was powerless, forced to try to use, even to obey, the weak tool? This went through his mind, not for the first time, but even as he thought it, he was going over to the desk, to the telephone. He sat down and dialed direct distance to the HEW offices in Washington. The call, handled through the federal telephone switchboards in Utah, went straight through. While he was waiting to be put through to the Minister of Health, Education, and Welfare, whom he knew fairly well, he said to Orr, "Why don't you put us over in another continuum where this mess simply never happened? It would be a lot easier, and nobody would be dead. Why didn't you simply get rid of the aliens?" "I don't choose," Orr said. "Don't you see that yet? I follow." "You follow my hypnotic suggestions, yes. But never fully, never directly and simply." "I didn't mean those," Orr said. But Rantau's personal secretary was now on the line. While Haber was talking, Orr slipped away, downstairs, no doubt, to see about the woman. That was all right. As he talked to the secretary, and then to the minister himself, Haber began to feel convinced that things were going to be all right now, that the aliens were in fact totally unaggressive, and that he would be able to make Rantau believe this, and through Rantau, the president and his generals. Orr was no longer necessary. Haber saw what must be done, and would lead his country out of the mess. Chapter 9. Those who dream of feasting wake to lamentation. Truong Se, 2. It was the third week in April. Orr had made a date last week to meet Heather Leelock at Dave's for lunch on Thursday, but as soon as he started out from his office, he knew it wouldn't work. There were by now so many different memories, so many skeins of life experience jostling in his head that he scarcely tried to remember anything. He took it as it came. He was living almost like a young child, among actualities only. He was surprised by nothing and by everything. His office was on the third floor of the Civil Planning Bureau. His position was more impressive than any he had had before. He was in charge of the Southeast Suburban Park section of the City Planning Commission. He did not like the job and never had. He had always managed to remain some kind of draftsman, up until the dream last Monday that had, in juggling the federal and state governments around to suit some plan of Haber's, so thoroughly rearranged the whole social system that he had ended up as a city bureaucrat. He had never held a job in any of his lives, which was quite up his alley. What he knew he was best at was design, the realization of proper and fitting shape and form for things, and this talent had not been in demand in any of his various existences. But this job, which he had, now, held and disliked for 5 years, was way out of line. That worried him. Until this week, there had been an essential continuity, a coherence among all the existences resultant from his dreams. He had always been some kind of draftsman, had always lived on Corbett Avenue, even in the life that had ended on the concrete steps of a burnt-out house in a dying city in a ruined world, even in that life, up until there were no more jobs and no more homes, those continuities had held. And throughout all the subsequent dreams or lives,
many more important things had also remained constant. He had improved the local climate a little, but not much, and the greenhouse effect remained, a permanent legacy of the middle of the last century. Geography remained perfectly steady. The continents were where they were. So did national boundaries, and human nature, and so forth. If Haber had suggested that he dream up a nobler race of men, he had failed to do so. But Haber was learning how to run his dreams better. These last two sessions had changed things quite radically. He still had his flat on Corbett Avenue, the same three rooms, faintly scented with the manager's marijuana, but he worked as a bureaucrat in a huge building downtown, and downtown was changed out of all recognition. It was almost as impressive and skyscraping as it had been when there had been no population crash, and it was much more durable and handsome. Things were being managed very differently now. Curiously enough, Albert M. Myrtle was still president of the United States. He, like the shapes of continents, appeared to be unchangeable, but the United States was not the power it had been, nor was any single country. Portland was now the home of the World Planning Center, the chief agency of the Supranational Federation of Peoples. Portland was, as the souvenir postcard said, the capital of the planet. Its population was 2 million. The whole downtown area was full of giant WPC buildings, none more than 12 years old, all carefully planned, surrounded by green parks and tree-lined malls. Thousands of people, most of them FedPeep or WPC employees, filled those malls. Thousands of people, most of them FedPeep or WPC employees, filled those malls. Parties of tourists from Ulaanbaatar and Santiago de Chile filed past, heads tilted back, listening to their ear-button guides. It was a lively and imposing spectacle, the great handsome buildings, the tended lawns, the well-dressed crowds. It looked to George Orr quite futuristic. He could not find Dave's, of course. He couldn't even find Ankeny Street. He remembered it so vividly from so many other existences that he refused to accept, until he got there, the assurances of his present memory, which simply lacked any Ankeny Street at all. Where it should have been, the Research and Development Coordination Building shot cloudward from among its lawns and rhododendrons. He did not even bother to look for the Pendleton Building. Morrison Street was still there, a broad mall newly planted down the center with orange trees, but there were no Neo-Inca-style buildings along it, and never had been. He could not recall the name of Heather's firm exactly. Was it Foreman, Esserbeck, and Rudy, or was it Foreman, Esserbeck, Goodhue, and Rudy? He found a telephone booth and looked for the firm. Nothing of the kind was listed, but there was a P. Esserbeck attorney. He called there and inquired, but no Miss Leelock worked there. At last he got up his courage and looked for her name. There was no Leelock in the book. She might still be, but bear a different name, he thought. Her mother might have dropped the husband's name after he went off to Africa, or she might have retained her own married name after she was widowed. But he had not the least idea what her husband's name had been. She might never have borne it. Many women no longer changed their names at marriage, holding the custom a relic of feminine serfdom. But what was the good of such speculations? It might very well be that there was no Heather Leelock, that, this time, she had never been born. After facing this, Orr faced another possibility. If she walked by right now looking for me, he thought, would I recognize her? She was brown, a clear, dark amber brown, like Baltic amber or a cup of strong Ceylon tea. But no brown people went by. No black people, no white, no yellow, no red. They came from every part of the earth to work at the World Planning Center, or to look at it, from Thailand, Argentina, Ghana, China, Ireland, Tasmania, Lebanon, Ethiopia, Vietnam, Honduras, Liechtenstein. But they all wore the same clothes, trousers, tunic, rain cape, and underneath the clothes they wore all the same color. They were gray. Dr. Haber had been delighted when that happened. It had been last Saturday, their first session in a week. He had stared at himself in the washroom mirror for 5 minutes, chuckling and admiring. He had stared at Orr the same way.
That time you did it the economical way for once, George. By God, I believe your brains began.